If within this country I did what the British government has done in Iraq, I would be had up for armed robbery, rape, torture, and murder. But apparently when the government does it in another country, to other citizens of other countries, this is perfectly acceptable.
My grandfather had a firm that made spectacles. And my great-grandfather started off literally grinding one lens and then bringing somebody else in to grind a lens. And the basic example of small-time capitalism. My father wasn't interested in going into the family firm, so he became an actor and a very successful one. My mother, she became a casting director. And she worked for somebody called Hugh Beaumont, who was the head of HM Tennants, which at the time virtually ran the West End. Anyway, I knew I wanted to be an actor, partly because I absolutely hated the schools that I was sent to. At the age of 17, I got out as fast as I could. And then I was lucky enough to do an audition for Dundee Rep. And there was a man called Raymond Westwell, who my mother knew, who ran the theatre, and I worked there for 2 years solidly. And in a repertory system, you do a play every 2 weeks. And sometimes you play young men, sometimes you play old men, sometimes you play villains, sometimes you play saints, you know, it's just a complete, it's a very, very good training ground. And there were some quite illustrious actors there. Glenda Jackson was there, Nicol Williamson, Eddie Fox, Edward Fox, who's James Fox's brother. And I met my first wife there, Lucinda Curtis, and we came down from there and we lived in London, and gradually I got little bits of work. It's a very hard life being an actor, because you don't, until you become established to some degree, you're not really taken very seriously. It took a long time to gradually build up some sort of name.
Well, he was very much a good-looking young man with a upper-middle-class accent and well brought up. So he lent himself to a lot of roles, establishment roles, on television.
My name's Armstrong. I've just bought Eddington Hall and the estates.
Ah, you're the new squire. I intended to call on you. I didn't realise you were here already.
I didn't come here to exchange pleasantries, Doctor. Your daughter has just ruined an entire morning's hunting.
He's one of those actors that turns up and does a very good performance. He'll be bringing some piece of information, he'll be bringing a tea tray, he'll be bringing the murder weapon without knowing that he's doing so. He'll be kind of right in there at the heart of the plot and, you know, delivers his part well.
The professions was a kind of joke. I had to play some lunatic who was holding the British government to ransom. And he stood in Battersea Power Station with a whole lot of gas cylinders on his back and said he was going to gas the whole of London. It was long before the terrorist threat. This was a homegrown terrorist. It was an extremely silly script. I found it very difficult to actually film it because we were laughing so much because it was so stupid.
His death won't have been in vain.
I suppose the first part that gave me some sort of recognition was a television film called Philby, Burgess and MacLean, which was about the three spies who disappeared from India, or rather were spying for Russia. And I played MacLean. And it was a very good part. He was a bit of a drunk and quite a neurotic. I later discovered he actually went to the same public school that I'd been to.
He was in a couple of series before. I did recognise him actually from a series I'd never watched about Germans.
The character I was playing was based on a Luftwaffe intelligence officer who got 10 times the amount of information out of Allied prisoners who'd been shot down than the Gestapo did with all their thumbscrews and torture. And he did it by taking him out to meals.
making them feel at home, saying, we know you're a prisoner of war, but the war won't go on forever, so you might as well, you know, have a good time while you're here.
No harm will come to you. I only want to know if you can tell me who this plate was meant for.
Because he treated them extremely well, their tongues were loosened, and they did give away bits of information.
Possibly Mr. Cheney, if he's listening, might remember that. But you get more out of people by being pleasant to them than you do out of water torture.
And everybody knows. I don't understand. Well, I do. It's sadism. It's pure sadism. Everybody knows that torture is rubbish. Everybody knows that when you start being waterboarded or have your toenails pulled out or any of the other disgusting activities that they are into, anybody will say anything to stop it. If you're in that much pain, you will say absolutely anything. And if you think that's what they want to say, you'll say that. Quite apart from being against the Geneva Convention, but I think we're so far past caring about any form of international law that... You've got 700 cases of Iraqis in the High Court now suing the British Army and the British government for torture in Iraq. 700. It's rather more than a few bad apples.
When I first met him, he wasn't driven in the same way he subsequently became in political terms. He used his time off. He had lots, you know, he had house and family and lots of very straightforward responsibilities that we all carry through life.
We don't get a lot of artistic freedom. I mean, again, if you're a star, you probably do. I'm not a star. How much artistic freedom does an illustrator have? Well, only as much as the agency will say to them, we want an illustration for, and we need these things in it. Now, it's up to you to arrange them as you arrange them. But we don't want them there and there and there. We want them sort of all in the middle. I mean, whatever, you know. You artistic, unless you're starting from scratch and producing a painting or making your own film, then you have artistic expression. But actors have very little, very little freedom.
First of all, he started talking about technology, actually. He became very, very fascinated by... new technologies, nanotechnology, the idea of miniaturization, the idea that jobs were going to disappear from human grasp, work was going to become terribly computerized.
Captain Nida in Star Wars was a 1 week engagement, and I was on set for about an hour. In 3 days, I think. I mean, it was sweeping the stage and making sure there wasn't a spot of dust on it before one got onto the stage. It was really quite a boring job.
There's a great relationship between politics and the theatre, and I think Michael always exploited that. He was very keen to be in plays that had something political to say and made people engage in the politics of the time. And he's always regarded, since I've known him, the role of an actor as one that helps people understand and the politics of the day and actually galvanizes people to take action and become involved in politics.
In the 90s, I was asked to go down to the Tricycle Theatre. Up until then, I had not been a particularly political animal. Up until about 92, 94, I had not been a political animal, and half the picture had been seriously well researched by Richard Norton Taylor, who writes for The Guardian. And he had taken the Scott inquiry. Lord Chief Justice Scott had been charged to do an inquiry into the sale of weapons to Saddam Hussein by John Major. And listening to the testimony of these appalling people in Parliament and the civil servants, you just thought, this country's being run by lunatics, absolute lunatics.
He was absolutely excellent, so much so that the mother of that particular civil servant came to see the play and rang up her son afterwards and said, did you really have to behave in such a way at the inquiry? Because she almost thought that Michael was her son.
I mean, they say this man is a foul dictator, and yet they shovel weapons into his maw. Why? All the way through the 80s, as we know, he was fighting Iran, fueled by the Americans, by the British.
They're part of a hideous, amoral, almost, I wouldn't say evil, but part of a system that condones mass murder, international political corruption, and the continued sale of weapons of mass destruction throughout the First and Third World, simply for the purposes of business.
There is no room within my heart for revenge, fire, or hate. There is no room within my mind for any thoughts like these. I cannot find the words to say just how it is I feel, but I know from deepest hurt I must forgiveness find. The hurt that's been done to us cuts sore like a knife, but we must not repay in kind what has been done to us.
And then after that, we did Colour of Justice, which was about the Stephen Lawrence murder, the black boy who was killed by five or six white thugs at the bus stop. And Sir William McPherson, who is the only member of the establishment who I have ever heard seriously and serially criticise the police, and he called them institutionally racist, which they are. But the trouble is he didn't follow through from that, because if the police are institutionally racist, it means the entire society is institutionally racist, because the police are drawn from the society.
And that was probably the most arduous thing Michael did for us, because he played the judge who presided at the inquiry, which meant he was on throughout the play for 2.5 hours. And he had to keep immense concentration on everything that was happening in front of him and preside over the inquiry. It's very difficult for an actor to do that, because not for a second can he turn off. And yet he's not actually saying very much. He's just watching the proceedings and taking charge of them.
Living in a democracy isn't just about ticking a box. It's about being active and being a part of a functioning aspect of that democracy that has a voice and takes action and defines its anger and defines its criticism of the ruling authorities through its actions and through its words.
So that is when I started getting very, very political. I sort of thought, this is crazy. What is this country doing? But I then discovered that there's very little anybody, the average citizen, can do.
Oh, which is shorthand for you're going to ask awkward questions. Can we cut the crap and get on with it? I'm ex-job, remember?
The CIA came out with the fact that Afghanistan had between $2 and $3 trillion worth of raw resources. Copper, diamonds, you name it. Everything. Oil, gas. And you just went, so basically this is just robbery, basically. This is what free enterprise is. You murder the people and take their goods from them. And when Blair was told that it's all about oil, he said, oh, nonsense, that's complete fiction.
You know, I believe that democracy is as powerful as the group that maintains it, and he brings a voice, and he brings a very strong and committed voice, and I think that encourages other people.
So when I met Brian Hoare down in Parliament Square, I knew exactly what he was talking about, and he knew exactly what I was talking about, and I supported him for the rest of his life. And I made up banners for him, and I designed T-shirts for him, and I did everything I could.
I've counted approximately 20 to 30 human beings stood here on this ground, stood up for our fellow human beings, stood up for peace, to make peace. God bless you all.
He was an extremely eccentric but absolutely honest man who just thought that what we were doing was criminal, which was correct, totally criminal. And Blair and the whole of Brown and that entire cabinet should be tried at Nuremberg. They're all war criminals, as is Cameron. They're all war criminals, and yet nothing happens in this country.
Wake up, get up, come and join us. Thank you very much. Over to you. You're needed, by the way. You're needed. We all need it. Thank you.
Brian died in 2011, and he died because you cannot live in Parliament Square with that traffic going round all the time. And you're there every day. And he did smoke heavily as well, and he eventually got cancer of the lung. But he kept on and on and on right to the end, and I just found him a deeply impressive human being. He knew what he was talking about, he got it all researched.
Michael arrived on my doorstep 12 years ago, looking for someone to do a very large painting of the atrocities in East Timor.
Then we got another painting.
We got another painting done, which was also relating to East Timor. So we had an exhibition of the paintings.
Mrs. Thatcher hitting a human head straight out of canvas at you.
And Tony Blair.
Suharto, Blair, Kissinger.
And Kissinger. Playing the game, the great game, the great war game.
Mann has done an amazing painting, and I hope that it's the only thing that Thatcher's remembered for.
I don't think so.
What did somebody say just recently? If you had Pol Pot, Saddam Hussein, and Margaret Thatcher in the room with you, and you had a revolver with two bullets, who would you use it on?
Well,
who would you use the bullets on?
Well, who?
Thatcher. Both bullets.
What is the point of having a belief in something? It's like me saying, I've got this car I've made out of boxwood and plywood, and it's got two bicycle wheels, and I believe it can go as fast as a Maserati. People will just look at you and say, you know, can you prove it? Well, no, but I believe it. You know, the word belief should be, people shouldn't be made to understand that it means nothing. It is a meaningless word.
The people that he's up against don't care and aren't really the keepers, the protectors of our democracy.
I think Michael's reached an age where a lot of male actors have no longer work very much because it's very, very difficult. And maybe because he's sought out the most politically interesting plays to be in, he's not included himself in things that possibly are easier to get jobs in, like comedy and things like that. So he's always been very, very dedicated to the work he's done. And he might have excluded himself from other choice opportunities as an actor.
I mean, if somebody's not employed me because I've been on the pavement, they've not employed me because I've been on the pavement. But I don't know who they are if they have not employed me. I've just done a little job for the BBC, who I've been excoriating for the last 10 years because of their unbelievably one-sided coverage of what's going on. So the BBC has actually employed me, but it's a tiny little soap opera that goes out 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Nobody will see it anyway, or very few people will see it. And I'm forbidden under the contract of even mentioning it. I mustn't tell you anything about it. I mustn't even tell you the plot or what I'm playing or. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like, you know, their priorities are so screwed. But no, I can't say I know if anybody stopped me because of my political views. Not a clue. And I don't care. I shall go on doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. if eventually, I don't know what they'll do. I can't see, they can, it's called freedom of speech, isn't it? Of course, that may not be allowed much longer.
Why do you think we need permission to take photographs?
I am allowed a protest. No, I do not have to apply to anybody for protest. Nobody.
You want me to go on the pavement?
Without any written authorization, you can't do this. So that's fine.
Keep off the grass.
I know, you must go on the grass. Not just
protest. Calling you a protest.
I was protesting with one of my T-shirts on against that lying little shit Blair's journey, the journey that he was pushing as a book. A man came out of Waterston's, and as he passed me, he said, "Oh, grow up." To which I replied, as he walked away, I said, "Well, they won't be doing that in Fallujah, will they? Or only with three heads." You know, they don't. It's other people's pain, other people's suffering is nothing to do with us, and yet it is totally to do with us. Very few actually think, you know, this is appalling. And you get young American girls who are sort of 18 or 19, they don't know anything. They don't know anything. They're just the USA, you know, we stand for freedom. You go, no, you don't stand for freedom at all. You stand for torture and rape and genocide is what you stand for. As does this country.
I've always admired Michael as this political activism. He's very much against war, but more than anything else, he's against injustice and colonialism. And he's always worked hard, I think, to rally people around to against unjust wars and to influence public opinion in any way he can. And I admire that radicalism in him. I think it runs in the family because he comes from a great acting family tradition.
I don't think he's a sort of aberration. I think he's actually a positive byproduct of a social system in this country, which the rest of the world imagines just is completely rigid. And you know, if you're born like this and you speak like this, you're going to be like this. Not true. And Michael bears that out. He's a good upper middle class dissenter. There's been a lot of them, and they're a very strong and an honourable tradition historically. And I don't know about nowadays. I'm glad he's around.
And it's really, really depressing after a time because you can see no light at the end of the tunnel. You can see no chance of anything changing in the political climate of this country. None at all. You've got Cameron saying, "Oh yes, we want endless wars. We'll sort out the Middle East. We just got to fight a few more wars." You go, you've killed 2.5 million in Iraq. You've killed God knows hundreds of thousands in Afghanistan. You've killed them in Libya. Anyway, so as I say, I see no change, and they all think it's perfectly wonderful. What do you do?
Say we have a free press, we don't have a free press at all. It's owned by about three people. What is free about that? Three people, giving owning the Times, the Telegraph. Where's freedom? That's freedom. We have the absolutely appalling views of Murdoch, the Barclay brothers, and now we've got a Russian spoof called Lebedev in charge of the Independent. I mean, you know.